You're listening to KYRS Medical Lake Spokane 88.1 and 92.3 FM. The program is Praxis. I'm your host, Taylor, and as you probably know by now, I am out of town this month and I have a whole slew of awesome pre-recorded shows for you. I'm really excited about today's show. It features Rebecca Long and Emily St. Pierre, both of local nonprofit Future Ada. So they're going to talk more about their work on digital privacy and security and getting more women involved in STEAM. So without further ado, here is that interview. All right. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Praxis on KYRS Thinner Community Radio. I'm pre-recording this interview with two wonderful people who are both new guests. They're going to talk about their organization, Future Ada. So I guess if you just each want to introduce yourself a little bit about who you are, and then we can dive into the organization and all the work you do.
Sure. Sounds great. Thanks for having us here. My name is Rebecca Long, and I'm the president and founder of Future Ada. And we're a Spokane-based nonprofit, 501c3, and we advocate for and support women in tech, women in STEAM, which is science, technology, engineering, art, and math. And we also support gender minorities in all of these fields, and we strive for a fully diverse and inclusive space for all of the sciences. And we've been around for about a year and a half now, and we're picking up some speed, but we're still pretty young and excited about everything that we're growing into.
Cool. Yeah, and I'm also excited, and I'm Emily St. Pierre, and I am a privacy ambassador for Future Ada. I actually met Rebecca last year at a hacker conference, and we've been partnering up to do these workshops for the community on privacy and security since last December now. And it's been amazing to see it grow, and it's been amazing to get to work with Rebecca and kind of see where we're going to go next with all of these initiatives.
Awesome. So I'm assuming, since you met at a hacker conference, you each have a personal background in tech.
That is correct.
Yeah.
So I went to school for computer science out at Eastern Washington University, and my master's research was in social engineering and phishing. And now I work in software engineering at a local startup that does works in the cybersecurity space.
And I got my start into security while I was attending the College of Southern Nevada out in Las Vegas. And I actually dropped out of high school when I was much younger, and I decided to go back to school. I fell in love with math, networking, IT, forensics, electronic crime is one of the associates I did. And from there, I took an internship to do security audits, and I got into what's called penetration testing. So penetration testing is when you're trying to test a client or an organization's security posture. This can take the shape of trying to do kind of hacking like you see on TV, so into like networks, or like trying to hack into someone's email, well, business email. But it's also like, how do you get into their wireless networks? How do you get into their web applications, like their websites, and all sorts of others that I won't go into, but it's been pretty cool so far.
Yeah, I'm not going to lie, and this is going to totally date me, but all I can picture is the early 90s film Hackers.
Yeah. That's a classic. Absolutely. Yeah. The best.
Yeah. So, basically here with two young Angelina Jolies, circa Hackers.
Oh, that's such a compliment.
Great film. Thank you. So I guess that leads us to part of the reason that I wanted to bring you two on the show was to talk about the digital security workshops, because it's a big issue for activists. And I know for me, for a long time, I've done some stuff to step up my game, and I won't reveal too much about my own personal security protocol on the radio, but it's a really daunting task for people. And I think people who don't feel like they're techie, and I notice it in it's a gendered pattern too, are really kind of scared off by this idea, or they have the idea when all of the NSA leaks came out, you know, well, I don't have anything to hide. So, I don't know, I guess, can you address kind of the intent of your security workshops and what some of the reactions to them have been?
I like that you brought up the I have nothing to hide kind of commentary. It's something that we hear really often. I mean, I hear it from my parents. Well, I used to hear it from my parents. I got them to see the light finally. You know, it's not about having nothing to hide. And as I demonstrate in the workshops with Rebecca, what we're trying to make the public understand is that the more information you have about someone, the more information you can use to target them or to craft attacks on them. I'm thinking things such as phishing or vishing, which is over the phone, or guessing someone's security questions. You know, having nothing to hide doesn't prevent, or, you know, being a good person, being a good citizen, your average good law-abiding citizen, first off, doesn't prevent you from being a victim of an attack or from identity theft. That's not how attackers work. Attackers or hackers, I mean black hat hackers, so those that aren't doing it for good, they're opportunists. If they see that you are sharing all of your information, the street you grew up on, your mother's maiden name, your cat's name, you know, everything you have on social media, if I can take that information, reset all of your security question answers, well, then it doesn't matter that you were a law-abiding citizen, right? So these are definitely some issues that we touch upon in the workshops, and we try to kind of give a broad understanding to the public of how, you know, obviously with my experience at work, I try to use that with stories and some things I've noticed during my engagements, and show how it could happen, you know, in everyday life. And of course, the main goal is to give tips and steps so that anyone can achieve better security. 100% security is never achievable. I don't try to sell what can't happen, but the whole goal is to really minimize the risk that an opportunist will be like, well, you're just so open, you just have so much information on you out there, or perhaps you are targeted, you know, and just making it harder for a malicious hacker or a malicious person to be able to get a hold of your accounts or make your life kind of miserable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a really good response to the I don't have anything to hide argument, which you hear a lot. And I think it's like you said, you know, 100% security is impossible, which I think people understand about the physical world. You know, people know, like, I could leave my house and get struck by lightning or hit by a bus or whatever, and I think people are more comfortable with that. But what do you think it is about the digital realm of our lives that, I mean, people have, average people and people who know more, have fed so much information into the internet as a whole? I don't know.
I think I get where you're going. Whereas, you know, it is, I think as a tech community, and I don't think we've done a good enough job at educating the public in general about how data works, how data is distributed, how it's bought, how it's sold, how it's packaged. I don't think we've done enough education in regards to showing people, kind of lifting the veil behind all of their data, how we collect their data and how we share their data, and how that might affect them, affect their everyday security. Again, that's what we're trying to do with these workshops. But I think it's hard as an everyday person, right? When you're interacting with websites, with your apps, with, you know, everything that you come into contact with, perhaps your banking, let's take one example. You know, I am using Google for my mail inbox, you know, and I've been doing it for years. And perhaps, you know, the information that, you know, I'm just using it to send messages, send emails back and forth, communicate. Am I really trying to, it's not very I guess what I want to say, evident what kind of information Google is tapping into or collecting on myself. It's not very evident how that information might affect my security. And that's because we're giving our information to these private companies. They don't have a requirement to tell us what they're doing with our information. Mm-hmm. And truth be told, we don't really have many laws currently to protect us against having our information used in ways that we really wouldn't want. Mm-hmm. So does that kind of...
It does. That's exactly what I was trying to get at with people's level of trust.
Yeah. And speaking to the legal system, a lot of our... the folks that get elected to office that are making those laws, they're just like the public. They're not very well educated on what is being done with this information or how technology really works. And technology moves so quickly. It's hard to keep up. And so, and it takes so long to create a law. By the time a law goes into effect, it might already be outdated with technology stuff, depending on what it's addressing. And that's a complicated, tough spot to be in. And one of the things that I'm hoping is that at some point that we'll be able to educate more activists and more politicians and people looking to go into office on what these issues are by, you know, with these workshops and other types of advocacy that we're doing. So that hopefully that'll change. But that's a tough spot right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I remember that really, I guess a couple years back and a few years before that also, when the quote unquote net neutrality debate was really heating up. I mean, hearing the debates and the presentations in Congress, is pretty clear that, you know, most of our leaders have a very vague conception of
They had no idea
what the internet is. In a tangible physical way, and also its history. And its history is not corporate. Its history is not five corporations trading private data back and forth.
Right.
So, yeah. One thing I was going to mention, when you talked about Google and Gmail, I think that's a perfect example because, and this is where I think the line between security and privacy, which is something I'm really interested in hearing from both of you too, comes up. I think most of the time when you do get a glimpse of what kind of information Google is keeping about you, it's presented almost as a convenience. And I remember the first time I was composing an email to someone and it's like, oh, would you like to include these two other people? We assume that these two other people need to be with this person with this subject line. And it was like, oh, that was a small wake-up call for me, you know. So how does that work? I mean, also with home devices like Alexa and Google Home, how does convenience play into all of this?
That's a great question. So convenience and ease of use is really the carrot, right? It's what those companies use in order to collect more data. Yeah, I mean, I don't blame someone for wanting to make their life easier and saying, like, you know, has been such a time saver to, you know, just automatically fill my emails. Like, there's the recipients we're talking about, but now it will autocomplete some phrases, you know, things of the sort. I mean, just from the mail perspective. But, you know, if I take my phone sometimes, maybe I'll have Google suggest, you know, a route or like a coffee shop, or if you're looking at ads, perhaps you were speaking to someone about Lamborghinis the other day, and then, oh, you have your ads have Lamborghinis.
My mother just had a story about this the other day. She was talking to me on the phone. She wasn't even searching for anything, and she said that we were chatting about, I don't remember what, but whatever it was like some random topic she would not normally. And she said that she got an ad for it, like immediately, like the next day from Google. And she she made a comment to me. She's like, is this normal? Like, sorry, Mom.
Yeah. That we have these listening devices that in our pockets, and they track us and they listen to what we do and they know where we go. They know where we work because they're keeping track of us. We emit and share a huge amount of information. Because we all have these devices on us, typically at all times. And this is incredibly convenient for these companies that will use that data because they're profiting off of our data. You know, some companies will be a bit more privacy focused than others, but and there's also a case I was just talking to a colleague about, is that sometimes there are cases where not sharing your data is going to cost you more. I know there were some, I believe it was with AT&T, where there was this issue that if you did not want to share some of your browsing data, you were going to have to pay a premium for that. And so there's the basic business model that I think a lot of us are familiar with, which is we get a service for free, email, maps,
Facebook,
social media, for free, and then they get to sell our data. And I think most people understand that. But I think we're also coming to this point where if you want your privacy and you don't want your data to be shared, first off, there's not that many options available to you. It's going to require a lot of time investment. Typically, if you want to be privacy conscious, you have to, you know, learn Linux. You have to learn how, GPG works. And, you know, it just requires a bit more time. And then there's also this case, like, as I mentioned with AT&T, where you're going to have to pay more in order to make sure that a company doesn't sell your data. So, you know, we need, you know, these legal frameworks in place to help prevent that.
Yeah.
So that's a perfect segue into learning this. So your whole thrust, it seems, from everything we've talked about of Future Ada, is that you are bringing education and empowerment through education around technology. So I guess what spawned that idea for you, Rebecca, as the founder, and why education? It might seem kind of obvious, but
so I wanted to start this organization because as a woman in tech, I've been in tech for 10, 15 years, and I continually be in like one of the few or only woman on my team or on my project, or, you know, the only girl at a networking event that's tech related. I do appreciate the short lines at conferences that I go to, but also, there's a lot of problems that come out of not having a very diverse set of people in tech. And so like, harassment, discrimination, that kind of stuff comes up, and I had been dealing with some of that. And there's a dropout point where statistics show there's like 40% of women leave tech after 10 years. And I was getting to that point where I was so frustrated with things that I was ready to leave. And then I discovered there was some other women that I respected that were further in their career that were feeling the same way. And I realized that that's not fair. Mm-hmm. Like, we're very qualified people, highly technical, and we need to have a seat at the table to help solve a lot of our world's problems, right? And so I thought, well, we should get an organization together that helps encourage more women and diverse people to come into the field, and then also to help the women and the minorities that are already in it to feel welcomed, feel safe, to feel wanted, so that they can stay in the field as long as they want and they don't feel pushed out before they're ready, mm-hmm. basically. And so one of the ways it's like, well, how do you do that, right? There's a whole pipeline of per the pipeline problem, right? Mm-hmm. And so, well, it's like we need to get more people in, need to keep them in, you know, patch the pipe, so to speak. And then there's a lot of cultural issues that help, you know, push people away or off put people that don't fit the typical, quote unquote, typical mold of a tech person, right? And education is going to be one thing. Need to encourage and inspire kids and people of all ages to consider tech and realize that it's not scary, because that is a big thing that I notice in the community is, well, I don't do tech, or I don't know, I'm not a tech person, I'm not a technical person, I don't do coding, I don't know, right? There's that immediate reaction because that's what they've grown up to believe, mm-hmm. for one reason or another. Or I don't fit the mold, I'm not the nerdy white guy, mm-hmm. and so obviously I can't do it. We're trying to break that mentality, because the whole world runs on tech. We're using tech right now to record all of this. Mm-hmm. We have our phones are tech. We have laptops that are tech. We have our computers are tech. Our refrigerators are tech. Mm-hmm. I mean, like, everything in the world is going to tech. It's going to be connected to the internet, and everyone needs to understand it at least some basic level, and they need to not be afraid of it. And then that's going to help inspire people to dive deeper into certain areas and to get involved more. And so that's kind of what our organization is trying to do, is inspire people to go in and consider all these fields. We're not going to force them in, but there's a baseline. I think tech is kind of one of those basic things that we all need to know about these mm-hmm. days, reading, writing, computers.
Yeah, honestly.
Yeah. And security plays into that, right? And so, like, if you're going to have to deal with tech, then we want you to have a baseline understanding of what that means and how to protect yourself. And so that's all coming through education.
Yeah. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Praxis on KYRS. This is a pre-recorded show that I recorded at the end of June with Rebecca and Emily of Future Ada. We're talking about women in tech, security for activists, and everyone else who doesn't know they're an activist yet, and all of that. So, I want to go back to the diversity question, because I think it's really important. And I think at this point, people are hearing, you know, women in STEM, women in tech so much that I think I've encountered folks, specifically men who work in tech, who are like, oh, well, that's solved because people are talking about it now. and it's the same in my field, in the audio field. It's like hyper minority women. And in the program I'm in, we're also a super minority, and it's a very interesting dynamic. So I guess, can you talk just on the macro level, how does that lack of diversity play out from end to end outside of issues like harassment? Like, how does it affect what gets made, how it gets made, and how we interact with the systems that are getting built?
Yeah, I have a couple really good examples. Mm-hmm. One is not gender based, so it's more, I guess, relatable even to men. So a lot of people use YouTube these days, and we all have phones. So we have the YouTube app, and when it first came out on an iPhone, the folks at the YouTube team noticed that a lot of the videos were like upside down or something. They were, and it's like, why are all these videos they're not oriented correctly? And they didn't understand it. It took them a while, and then they figured out that left-handed iPhone users were the cause. And so the team at YouTube that made the mobile app were all right-handed people, and they didn't even think that a left-handed person might use the phone differently.
Might flip the phone the other direction.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that's kind of a silly example, but I mean it's true. If you're not thinking about it in a diverse form of like all the different ways you can use, you know, whatever product you're building, then there's going to be little silly quirks like that. Hopefully they're more on the silly side, like that mm-hmm. one. A more broader example, or a scarier example, would be that I like to use is airbags in cars. So that you would think it's 2019. we've had women driving for a while. Cars have been around for a while. Airbags have been around for a while. But airbags actually were designed for the average body style size of a man, which is generally, speaking, bigger than the average size of woman, right? And so the force of an airbag would actually injure or kill women, because there was no women on the airbag team when they were designed. And they actually didn't switch the law for that until like 2008.
It was recently.
Yeah, I think. And so cars made after that are safe for women to drive. But before that, It's kind of scary.
I was going to say airbag, yeah, because they always had like male crash test
dummies. The crash test dummies were the like 6'5", you know, male.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so that's what they tested it on. And then they didn't even have to test on a smaller sized airbag or a crash test dummy until after that law passed. And it took a long time. That's an extreme example of a lack of diversity on a team, you know, can cause something that dramatic. So we have two sides of the spectrum of like, we have all sorts of, you know, a range of things that could happen. And so we have, since everything's moving into tech, right, the whole world, we have, if we only have one fraction of society, right, the standard, mostly white, male set of folks that are coming up with solutions for everybody, they're not going to be able to think about it, of what, you know, what's a woman need? What's a person of color need? What's a person of this, you know, religion or this country? Like, there's different cultural values that they're just not gonna naturally think of. They would have to try really hard. And even then, like, generally speaking, we can only view things from our perspective, and we need to have other voices that help advocate for those other views so that they can come into the solution and make sure that, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's
also, and just regardless, like, all the ideas, right. You know, it's ridiculous to expect that something like, you know, maybe 12% of the population is going to have 100% of the good ideas.
Right.
Which is how we've been operating for a long time.
Right. And yeah. And that's just ridiculous. Like, we have people have, everyone has good ideas, and there's no reason we shouldn't listen to them.
Yeah. So what, I guess if people are interested, and if they're adults or their kids or whatever, what are some ways that people, that women, other people who maybe haven't been in tech before can kind of plug in?
So we offer a workshop, a one-day workshop every year. And I think this year we're pushing it to spring, called Django Girls. And it's a one-day, full-day workshop. It's free to the public, but it's for women and non-binaries specifically, so the gender minority. And you can walk in not knowing how to code, and you walk out with a blog that you've written yourself, right? So you learn how to program, you learn some Python coding, and you learn how to push it into the cloud, and so you can actually use it when you go home, right? And we've done it a couple years in a row so far, and it's just been really inspiring to see people come in and walk out feeling like, oh my gosh, like, this isn't scary. I can actually do this. I had no idea. So that's a big one we really, really like. There's also, I know Spark Central has a every other month they do a Girls Code at Spark event, and so it's for kids. They can go in and learn some basic programming, which is really exciting, and I volunteered there. And then we have some other stuff, but that's probably the best ones for, like, the immediate, if you don't know, tech. And what we're looking at doing some more introduction to tech as a thing, just kind of on a broader scale. Maybe you want to talk about the office hours?
So one of the things we will be introducing soon are open office hours, and we want to have a place once a month where people can drop in with any of their tech-related questions. And this can be anything from, I'm not sure what this means on my mobile phone, to my computer's acting up, or how do I get better privacy online? And it will be just a few hours, kind of an open office hour type of concept. And everyone's welcome to drop in. We'll be posting that on our social media and on our blog for more information. As we haven't started it yet, but it's coming soon. And it's really just to, whatever your tech problem, your tech question, there's no judgment. You can come in, and we're going to help you find a solution, hopefully, and kind of, or explain what's going on.
That's awesome. Yeah, I know it changes things a lot to just learn even a couple basic things. Just learning like some basic computer science, like, how does binary work? Like, how does any of it work? Yeah, was just exactly. Like, oh, this is approachable, you know, to me. And yeah, So that's really cool. And also, I'll just say that coding blogs is like the ultimate gateway drug to, as someone from the generation who learned how to code on MySpace, like.
For me, yeah. It was Neopets. Awesome.
Yeah. Yes. Yes. That was where I went after I went through the gateway of MySpace. Yeah. Yeah. So, and then, you know, getting hired at a job and they're like, wow, you know how to do this? And I'm just like,
You're like MySpace, Juice City's Neopets.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, and now, you know, there's new versions of that kids are working on now, and kids are doing wild stuff now. I know I've seen, you know, video of hacking conventions that are elementary school kids, like taking down bank websites and stuff, yeah. You know, and hacking voting machines. And
yeah, that's the hacker conference that we met at. Mm-hmm. They have a kid version of it.
They have a kids village at DEF CON
Kids, isn't it?
Oh, I forget what it's called.
Something like
but
that.
It's there. It's every year at DEF CON. There's a big village for families to come in and kind of introduce their kids to the concept of hacking. Because representation, I wish I had that as a kid.
Yeah.
I didn't even know I could get paid to be an ethical hacker until years down the line.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I think that's one of the big things too, is like people need to see someone in those roles, that representation, the role model, like, oh, you can do it, so can I.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you wouldn't necessarily think about it if, you know, otherwise.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So can you unpack that actually for a listening audience who may have never heard the term ethical hacker until right now?
Yeah, absolutely. I kind of touched upon it, of penetration testing. Well, I am a penetration tester, slash what that means is I'm an ethical hacker. So organizations will hire myself or some of my colleagues or groups of us to test their security posture or their perimeter. And I think I mentioned some like network, kind of like what you see in movies, like hackers or sneakers. But also physical security.
Mm.
And I was going to mention, like, you know, we have had such a lack of diversity in penetration testers. And I was actually the first woman pen tester at my company. And it's funny because I had to go and do this bank once. And I was like, I bought a fake pregnancy belly online off of Amazon and use that as a disguise, or as a pretext, as we call them, to kind of try to bypass security and make sure that people might first off never suspect me, because I
mm-hmm.
and kind of leave me alone or kind of leave me to do my bidding. And so that was like the way that I was like, okay, I'm going to take back this lack of diversity and kind of use it to infiltrate this bank. And it was awesome. So an ethical hacker is really just there to, you have to be hired. Otherwise, it's not, like, if you don't have permission, it's not legal, then you're not an ethical hacker. And you're really there to test organization. This can be a public organization, like a city, or like a transit department, a healthcare organization, a private organization. So that's what we do.
That sounds so fun. I'm not going to lie. And on that note, I guess, I think people, as you just said, you know, have a lot of like stereotypes in their minds about what hacking is. And, you know, there's just a lot of talk in the media around politics and other groups and even like leaks and distribution of information that's been accessed. What do you think people should know about that world in general that they don't?
I mean, hackers in general are people that typically have a good breadth of knowledge of technology or whatever technology that they're working with. They should know that there's different types of hackers. Hackers typically has a negative connotation. I gave a presentation once, and when I said I was an ethical hacker, someone was like, you know, snickered and said, that's not possible. And so I had to explain that, you know, there are the ethical hackers that are paid or hired by companies, have their permission to test their security. And then there's the unethical. We can also call them black hat, typically hackers, which these are more of your criminal organizations where you have perhaps groups of hackers, you know, that are coming together to either distribute ransomware, so or perhaps try to exploit vulnerabilities to gain access to people's private information. I'm thinking credit cards or thinking healthcare information, any kind of information that could help them profit off of it. So financial or health, social security, identity theft type information. The ransomware is a little bit different where, you know, they'll try to get some malicious code into a network or perhaps different types of computers and then hold those hosts for ransom. Other types of black hat hackers would be, it depends. I don't like to put them in the bucket because I think some hacktivism or hacktivists, I think they can hold a lot of power and maybe shed light on some issues that are important.
Would they be more gray hat?
They could be. Maybe. Like, I think there's some free speech issue here. Like, if you're a hacktivist, you deface a website to bring light on an issue. Is that a form of, this is a form of activism. It's not really legal. But I mean, so, yeah, it's a gray area. And security researchers are kind of in a gray area in that they might not necessarily exploit, but they will try to perhaps break the security of certain devices, perhaps certain websites. And, you know, to highlight that there's a huge flaw perhaps in this service or website. But again, it all depends on whether or not, you know, the company is happy with it or not. Typically, they're not. And if they call law enforcement, because we have a pretty broad, what's called Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, so a pretty broad law when it comes to looking at what is legal and what is illegal to do on the internet. And typically, just connecting to a system that's not yours, especially if it's a government system. And I'm not an attorney, but under that law, you could say like, oh yeah, that can go under the CFAA, because there have been cases where, you know, you're just connecting, you're just guessing a URL from a government website, and now you're in legal trouble because of something very simple, because you were curious and you were kind of playing with a URL, like, so like say it's HTTP. You know, bears.gov/, you know, and then you're putting bears.html or bears2.html, and just playing with that, you know, how could something very simple is getting you in legal hot water. So there's all sorts out there of hackers. There's not just bad ones.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so with that, and with the question, knowing that the audience of this show is primarily activists or people who are interested in kind of social change stuff, knowing that we're talking about personal security and also just the reach of these powerful tech companies and data mining companies, how do you think folks can have a balance, and this is for both of you, between reasonable scrutiny and care and paranoia? Because I know we have a big culture around paranoia around technology and kind of an assumption that it's omniscient and all powerful. How do you think people can balance that out?
I think education is going to be a big key to that, because I think a lot of paranoia comes out of not understanding what the risks are, what the real risks are, and some simple ways to help mitigate them. And that's kind of what our work, we have a workshop dedicated to community activists, because community activists and organizers are more in the public eye. And so there is a balance, like you can't just like disconnect from the internet and hide in a hole, right? You are a public figure and you need to be visible, and it does make you more of a target compared to like the average citizen. But I mean, that is kind of education, understanding where you can be, you know, visible, but but you know, have good safe passwords and use a password like keeper and you know, some, there's some simpler things that I'll let Emily kind of speak to.
I was gonna say the biggest thing is to understand who your threat is. You know, who we do threat modeling, you know, as organizers. We need to understand, who are we securing ourselves against? Is it a local hate group? Is it law enforcement? Is it a specific person? And everything in between. Understanding who your threat is going to be key into being able to tailor how much security you need, and or can you be fine with just general security?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So if you're just joining us toward the last part of the show here, you're listening to Praxis, talking to Rebecca and Emily from Future Ada. You can find them at futureada.org. Right. I always start saying a URL and then I'm like, I sure hope this is right. So, yeah. And just in the last 10 minutes or so that we have, I also wanted to make sure to bring up the March for Science, because I know you kind of took the helm of that this past year. And I think you're going to continue to do that, right?
Yeah, that's the plan. And we turned it this year. So we got involved this year and we turned it into more of a science symposium versus just a march and a rally. And nothing against marches and rallies. A big fan of those. But science is so exciting that we wanted to like make it into something to share the cool science, like research and science projects that are going on in Spokane. And a lot of the organizers around the country did something similar this year, and we're hoping to keep it up going next year and forward, where we just, you know, celebrate the cool stuff going on. And then, and we can get people excited about science, we can get people, you know what's going on, where they can get plugged in. And there's, you know, environmental stuff that you can volunteer for. So what is that about? Like, let's learn about that. How do you get involved where you can, you know, get, like, help advocate to, you know, representatives to vote in ways that are more in line with, you know, good science, or just educate our representatives on science as a thing and what's important to, you know, our world. Yeah, and so that's kind of what we were doing this year, and we had a pretty good turnout. I think we had 150 people that made it. Which was pretty good for having this kind of shift, and it was on Bloomsday weekend, which was we drew a pretty good crowd considering. We were really happy with it.
Yeah, well, and I love that shift, because I think the original march was a little bit in reasonable reaction to the terrible policies that we're facing and the terrible illiteracy that our society is overtaken by, but science isn't an ideology,
right?
You know, it's a process.
Yes.
Yeah, I'm always surprised when people say I don't believe in science or something. It's like, like, what?
It believes in you, baby. Like, yeah. And I mean, that's all over the place, so I think that's a really important aspect of the work you're doing between climate and health.
I mean, that's one of the other things too with the March for Science. It gives us an opportunity to make it more welcoming and approachable to the community, because again, similar to tech, it can be off-putting to some people who don't have a background in it or haven't seen a role model or don't have that in their circle of doing like science experiments or any type of environmental anything, or you know. And so it's just, we want to make sure that people get pulled in and see that they can do that too, or at least care about it.
This is totally left field, but related to that, and something I'm always curious to ask people who work in tech. I'm always really pulled both directions, because my original background is in environmentalism. In some ways, I'd like to be a total Luddite, but I also love technology and I'm really fascinated by it. A lot of people I meet and encounter, and the dominant culture that's presented by the tech industry, is kind of this like tech utopia, you know, like we're gonna save the world with these devices. So I'm wondering where you each fall on that spectrum, and what do you think the role of technology is in mitigating some of these giant problems that we have to confront?
Good. That's a really good
no big deal.
Question. Yeah. That's a very big question. I love technology. I like tech devices. I would love to, be a little bit more. I would not be against like a bionic implant or something at some point in the future, you know, like where you see the kind of stuff in the movies that help you. You know, you can have your phone that's part of your, you know, your arm or something, and it's not like a watch. I don't know. Like, that kind of stuff I'm not totally against, but at the same time, mm-hmm. there's a lot of, like, risk factors, and I would not want to be on the front lines of trying any of that. I don't know. That's a hard one. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think since my job is to misuse technology and pretty much from Monday to Friday, it's always, I think my takeaway is that technology can be used in good ways and bad ways or in unintended ways. And it's always really important to get those hackers into those conversations. When you're developing technology and you're, especially if you're going to have a large group of the population, a large segment of the population to use that technology, have those conversations with hackers, have those conversations with groups that you maybe have overlooked, have a diverse group of people into the room with you when you're looking to say, okay, well, how could we use this for good? What are those unintended uses of technology and how might we exploit them?
Yeah, I think that's really important. Like, right, that helps with, or ties back to that diverse populace at the table coming up with those solutions. We might have a really good idea, but it might actually be a really bad idea for a huge subset of our community. And without having someone representing that part of the community at the table to be like, actually, this could be really bad for me, and I would never want that to be available because of this or this, or here's how we could maybe mitigate my concerns around this, because I mean, there are a lot of risks,
right?
Yeah
Well, yeah, it's, sorry to just drop a giant question like that on you. What do you think of the whole future of this whole planet and this industry that's in all of it? Yeah, so what else, I mean, we just have about 4 or 5 minutes left. What else do you want to share with the listening audience that I haven't asked you about?
Oh, we wanted to just extend an invitation to the other groups in the area, in the Spokane and area, to come and connect with us. We'd love to see how we can help perhaps solve some of your problems related to tech or to privacy or security. And so we'd like to extend an invitation, not just to public in general, but those other organizations. If you're a school, or if you're even a private workplace, and you'd like to see perhaps how privacy security might affect your employees or people in City Hall, or we'd like to have that conversation with you, and we'd love to see how we can brainstorm something together.
Yeah, we've been looking at doing partnerships with other organizations, other nonprofits in the area, to bring our security workshop to them and to their community, because each community has their own specific needs. Like, kind of, we were at the PJALS conference in February, I think, and that was really great because we got to reach out just to like focus on community activists, and so we're trying to do more things like that, as in addition to bringing it to the community at large, so we can have focused sessions for specific groups. So any organization that is interested in working with us or has a need that might be a good opportunity to connect and partner, we would love to hear from them.
Awesome. Yeah. And then I remembered I meant to ask about the name, and you explaining the name will also lead into, I'd love to hear from each of you just really quick, who was there a person who you looked up to, who represented you, who kind of opened that door for you in the way that you're hoping to for younger women and other minorities now?
Yeah, so our name is Future Ada, and we are named after Ada Lovelace, who was the first computer programmer back in the 1800s. And I think a lot of the women in tech and women in science has kind of been, at least in history, has been kind of pushed to the side. I mean, we just had the Hidden Figures movie came out not that long ago, which helps highlight it. Ada Lovelace was also in that same bucket where her story was kind of not very well known, and it's starting to, you know, come out now. And so I consider her to be very inspiring, and not since many people don't know that computer science wouldn't even be here without a woman. Definitely want to help highlight that. And then for me, I didn't really know about like diversity problems in tech until I was invited to come to a Google workshop for women engineers. So I was in computer science already, and then I went to this workshop down at the Google headquarters, and I was surrounded by all these women, and it was the most bizarre experience, and you can never unsee the lack of women when you go back into normal life, basically. And that's when I first learned about Grace Hopper, and I found her really inspiring, and she has the Grace Hopper conference, and going to things like that have been like just absolutely empowering and inspiring for me and my career.
Yeah, it's a great question, because as I was discovering like security, I didn't know really of anyone that represented me until I was knee deep into security and at school. I mean, there was always these teachers, men and women, that were very encouraging and kind of seemed to understand that I was maybe the only woman in my class, you know, and so they were very understanding and really helped push me forward. But I think when I got into the industry, I really admired people like Georgia Weidman, who's a fantastic pen tester and owns her own security firm now. And she published a book that really helped me get into security. I loved activists like Violet Blue that were a mix of tech and privacy. And she also had the book. I like to learn through books, different skills, or learn about the world through books. So I have a lot of authors on my list. But I'd say these two were definitely very influential women in my life. And then as I got to know people in person, as I'd go to conferences, I just would admire, and we'd just get to talk about how they would handle different problems. I'm thinking of Ian Coldwater, who has done a lot of initiatives for women in tech and bring women in security together just online, and using that to kind of empower women and minorities in general.
Awesome. Well, thank you both so much for taking the time to hang out with me and talk to me and educate me, and for all the work you do. So if you're just joining at the end of the show, you've been listening to Praxis. I've been talking with Rebecca and Emily from Future Ada. You can find them at futureada.org, and I'll put links to everything we talked about and anything else that you all want me to share in the podcast notes. So if you missed the show, you can catch the podcast later on tonight at kyrs.org/show/praxis, P-R-A-X-I-S. There's links to anywhere you might want to find a podcast there. You can also email me at praxis, P-R-A-X-I-S, at kyrs.org. So thanks again, you guys.
Yeah, thank you so much for having us.
And I'll be back next week with another show.
Because